From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first big headline out of President Obama's 2016 budget out this week: tax corporate profits abroad to help pay for desperately needed infrastructure repairs at home in the USA. With a little tax reform on the side, Republicans and Democrats agree our roads and bridges need help. Is this the way to do it? This hour on Point, American taxes and American infrastructure. Just look around. There is evidence aplenty of the problem. Last month, in Cincinnati, an unused bridge collapsed unexpectedly. Truck driver Eric Myers was almost crushed.
I was in the left lane. I just slowed down. It took a minute for cars to let me back in. And if it wasn't for that, there would have been cars under the bridge. You know, it looked like it was 3 feet in front of me when it started to fall. And I saw both sides. It was so close, I saw both sides just break and start to fall down. And I thought it was going to come through the windshield.
Bridges coming through the windshield. Here from 60 Minutes, this is reporter Steve Croft in a helicopter inspecting bridges around Pittsburgh with Andy Herman, former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Herman is here showing Croft a bridge that needs repair so badly they've created a structure to catch pieces of the bridge as they fall off.
See that structure underneath it? They actually built that to catch any of the falling concrete so it wouldn't hit traffic underneath it.
That's amazing.
It all comes down to funding. Right now, they can't keep up with it. 300 bridges become structurally deficient each year in the state of Pennsylvania. That's 1% added to the already 23% they already have. They just can't fix them fast enough.
It's all over. Our backyard, right here at On Point in Boston, big snows this week and lots of people stranded on trains that could, public trains, transport, subway and beyond, that could not move. After the second snowfall in 1 week, the MBTA Public Transport General Manager Beverly Scott said residents would be better off if they didn't use mass transit.
Quite candidly, if you don't have to wind up using the service, that probably is a plus. Okay, I'm just going to be candid. I've never said that in my life, but I don't want to wind up misleading anyone.
Never said it in her life, but she's saying it now, this week in Boston. Joining me first today from Washington is Jonathan Allen, Washington Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Jonathan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
I don't remember a budget plan in the past that put infrastructure so high in the kind of headline that the White House pushed out of it and linked it to such a kind of novel payment plan. This isn't gas tax. This isn't the traditional way of funding infrastructure in this country. What's the president proposing, Jonathan?
Well, I think, what you're seeing here is he's been wanting to fund infrastructure for a long time, and as you point out, has this very different way of paying for it. And what he's proposing to do is to tax companies' foreign earnings at 19% going forward. So if you're a U.S. company with a subsidiary overseas and you earn money over there, wants a minimum tax of 19% on that. A lot of companies are able to be taxed at a lot lower rate on that or not at all. And then also a 14% tax on the profits that they've accumulated overseas and parked them there over the course of the year, of the years. And this tax, people talk about it as repatriation, but actually the way that it would work is you would be taxed on those accumulated profits, whether or not you brought them back to the United States. What we're hearing on Capitol Hill now is a divide among Republicans. And I think that's what the president was hoping to do. He wanted to either peel some Republicans off or keep the, you know, create a divide that's politically advantageous for Democrats. But I am starting to hear some Republicans say that this is a plan that they are open to, maybe not at the percentage levels that the president wants to tax these foreign earnings, but that the construct is one that appeals to them.
The 19% would be a big reduction from the sort of standing 35% corporate tax rate. The 14% would be lower still, though not as low as some would like. And remind us, there is just a mountain of money parked abroad. I mean, I'm looking here at parked foreign earnings. GE has parked $110 billion abroad. Microsoft, $74 billion. Pfizer, $69 billion. Apple, $54 billion. A couple of trillion dollars in all parked abroad waiting for a tax holiday or something. That's what they're eyeing, I guess, Jonathan.
That's exactly right. There's no advantage to bring it back and have it taxed at 35% if you think you can have it taxed at 14% or 10% or 8% at some point. I think that a lot of the companies would like to bring some of that money home, but don't want to do it at that high tax rate or what they can see, you know, what they see as too high of a tax rate. As it stands, almost nobody pays the 35% corporate tax rate in the U.S. So whatever the gap is, it's actually probably lower than 35% for any individual company, between that 35% and the 14% on the accumulated profits or 19% on the future foreign earnings.
So they're talking in all with these changes, tapping into this about, I don't know, almost $500 billion, almost $500 billion that they would put into infrastructure. And I guess there we mean all the usual suspects, roads and bridges and rail and airports and all the rest, Jonathan.
Yeah, light rail, mass transit. The plan would be $476 billion for surface transportation over 6 years. And I think it's 476, right in that range. There is a tremendous desire on Capitol Hill among Democrats and a lot of Republicans to pay for infrastructure. And the Highway Trust Fund, which funds our infrastructure projects, is running out. It'll be dry in May if nothing is done. So there's a lot of desire to solve the problem. This is a creative approach. It may end up being something that a lot of Republicans can vote for if it goes to the floor.
Now, why is the Highway Trust Fund running out? That's the gas tax is what is supposed to fill that. I guess that hasn't been raised, even kept up with inflation, since 1993. Is the drop in oil prices driving down the revenues there, and gasoline prices driving down the inputs there?
I think the major factor is it wasn't, sort of built to be sustained for as long as it has been without any adjustment. That said, I imagine that with people buying gas at $2.20 instead of $5, they are getting less receipts coming in. And of course, if you raise the tax at some point, you'll get sort of a double benefit in terms of we're going to see gas prices go up again, and if you've raised the tax on them, you'll get more into the coffers there. There's a reluctance. Some people would like to raise the gas tax to pay for infrastructure. There's a reluctance among some folks to do that because they feel like their constituents will not be pleased that their gas is suddenly more expensive again based on a tax from Washington.
Though everybody says if you're going to raise it when gas prices are low, not when they're high. This is all widely seen as the start of perhaps a negotiation over these rates. Does the GOP look prepared to engage that negotiation? Okay, maybe it's not 19%, maybe it's something else. Maybe not 14 one-time percent, but something else.
I think so. I think there will definitely be a discussion about it. This is, the construct is one that Republicans have embraced before. Dave Camp, the Ways and Means chairman in the last Congress, who's no longer there, had put out a plan that looked something like this. It is an opening bid. It's a starting point for negotiations. It's an olive branch in a way to try to find a solution that works. And there's an old idea in Washington that if your only distance is between two numbers, finding the midway point's pretty easy. Doesn't take an abacus.
But nothing seems exactly easy in Washington lately. But we'll look at where that might go. Jonathan Allen, Washington bureau chief for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much for being with us today, Jonathan.
My pleasure, Tom.
Everybody's talking about infrastructure. In a speech last month, here was New York Governor Democrat Andrew Cuomo saying that New York infrastructure needs improvement, especially those gateway airports in New York.
We want to rebuild over these next few years, starting with our airports, because that is the gateway to business. And we really have not kept pace with the rest of the world and our competitors. You look at any report, it will talk about how the New York airports sorely lag in terms of development.
And the challenges and opportunities grow as we look ahead. Just this week, the Department of Transportation put out a big plan, 30-year plan for American transportation called Beyond Traffic. On Monday, here was the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, outlining some of that plan and the country's challenges.
Our country is facing some very, very significant headwinds when it comes to transportation, population growth, climate change. There's a number of factors. And if we don't get ahead of those challenges, we're going to find ourselves stuck in traffic for a long time.
We're going to talk in a moment with Matthew Slaughter, economist who says that the president's plan would destroy American jobs. Alan Auerbach joins us first from Berkeley, California, professor of law and economics at the UC Berkeley, director of their Tax Policy and Public Finance Center. Alan Auerbach, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
What do you make of the president decoupling all this from the old lock with gas taxes and going for tapping foreign earnings to rebuild American infrastructure? As an economist, does that make sense?
Uh, As an economist, it doesn't make a lot of sense to tie revenues to spending, particularly when they're unrelated. I mean, the gas tax is at least related to highway spending.
You mean particular revenues to particular spending?
Yes. This is something that economists generally shy away from unless there's some logical connection, the way there is, say, with payroll taxes and Social Security benefits, or with gas taxes and highway spending. There's not a lot of connection between the money that Apple makes overseas and crumbling highways.
Except but that it's money, and highways need money to be rebuilt.
As a political strategy, it certainly makes sense, and he's trying to go beyond the gridlock of the last several years by coming up with a tax proposal, which will get a lot of sympathy around the U.S. To spend on something that even Republicans acknowledge is a needed area.
As an economist, what about the infrastructure problem? Do you see a significant drag now and in the future if we don't find the money to fix it?
Well, it's terrible. I, listening to the governor of New York talk about New York airports certainly resonated with me. I've always felt that you could go to the third world without leaving the United States by flying into LaGuardia or Kennedy Airport. And we've seen evidence of collapsing bridges and crumbling highways around the country. There's no doubt that as we've spent money on a lot of other things in the U.S., infrastructure spending has really lagged behind.
Here was the president in his State of the Union address last month, stressing the need for a bipartisan infrastructure plan.
21st century businesses need 21st century infrastructure. Modern ports and stronger bridges, faster trains, and the fastest internet. Democrats and Republicans used to agree on this. So let's set our sights higher than a single oil pipeline. Let's pass a bipartisan infrastructure plan that could create more than 30 times as many jobs per year and make this country stronger for decades to come. Let's do it.
Let's do it, says the president. Republicans, okay, we want to work on infrastructure, they say, but very sensitive about how that's done. Here, just in December, this was Paul Ryan, Republican congressman in Wisconsin, now chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, talking with CEOs at the Wall Street Journal's CEO Council about what he wants a U.S. tax plan to look like, thinking about global competitiveness.
What we're after at the end of the day is a very globally and internationally competitive tax system so that the place where you want capital to be destined is America, so that where you want to be domiciled is America, so that our tax system is putting you in the best possible position to succeed, to grow, to create jobs, and to invest.
We're going to look at the long-range plans and view being rolled out on multimodal transportation by the Department of Transportation this week. But first, to the president's plan here, Alan Auerbach is with us, professor of economics and law at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us from Berkeley, California. With us as well right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Matthew Slaughter, Associate Dean, Professor of Economics at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Matt Slaughter, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Do you see the need for big infrastructure investment? B, is this the way to go? Your headline today, I guess not. It says in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, how to destroy American jobs.
Well, on the two points, I completely agree with Alan with his characterization of American infrastructure today is in many ways terrible. So the gentleman on from the American Society of Engineers earlier, their most recent report on the report card on the state of America's infrastructure, they graded the overall country at a D+.
And that's just breathtakingly horrible.
It is. And I think, you know, I call it the planes, trains, and automobiles test. Think about when you drive around in your daily commute. Think about when you fly in the country. And if you compare it to what you see in the rest of the world, Alan mentioned these airports. You go to Hong Kong, you go to Shanghai, you go to these emerging markets, and the quality and strength of their infrastructure there is really striking. On your second point about how to fund this, Alan voiced an important principle, which is the economics of linking particular revenue streams with particular spending isn't all that sound. And in particular, the global competitiveness of American multinational companies is a very big deal. These companies tend to do an outsized portion of America's investment in physical capital, investment in research and development. In 2012, they did almost 75% of all the private sector R&D in America. So when you have tax changes that make these companies less competitive abroad, that tends to hurt, not strengthen their ability to grow jobs and investments in America.
Do these companies, GE with $110 billion parked abroad, Microsoft with $74 billion, do they really need that to be competitive? If we take 14% of that away, is that really going to set them so far back on their heels?
So what's interesting, Tom, the reason that they have those unrepatriated earnings abroad is to level the competitive playing field against companies they compete with in foreign markets that are headquartered in other countries that have a tax regime where they don't tax the foreign earnings of their companies. In the United States, we are increasingly an outlier compared to other countries in the world in terms of taxing worldwide the earnings of our companies. Of the 34 countries in the OECD altogether, the United States is one of only six today that taxes worldwide the earnings of their foreign companies. So it really is a competitive issue for these U.S.-based firms.
Alan Auerbach, so we haven't been able to pay for the infrastructure. We haven't found the political will to do it in another way. Is there a significant downside, to, in your view, as Matthew Slaughter says here, that we should keep us away from this pot of gold, even when things are crumbling at home?
Well, I don't think it's right to think of it as a pot of gold. I think it's right to think of it as an indication of the weakness of the current U.S. tax system. One of the reasons why the profits are parked abroad, and I think this was mentioned earlier in the hour, is that we had a tax holiday in 2004 when we allowed companies to bring profits home at a very, very low tax rate, sort of a fire sale on profit repatriation. And since then, the rate of accumulation of profits abroad has increased. Not just for normal reasons, but because companies now have come to expect that the government's going to do it again. And indeed, in this session, new session of Congress, there has already been bipartisan legislation introduced to have another tax holiday to allow companies to bring the money home. This is really a terrible policy. And
because it encourages them to just hold all that money offshore.
Money abroad, and in the end, we end up collecting very little money because we give them a very low tax rate. And my guess is that the president's proposal, although it's a higher tax rate and on all profits abroad, is going to morph into another tax holiday once bipartisan action is taken in Congress. And I don't think anybody, certainly I don't think any economist thinks that this is the way to run the tax system. And we would be much better off. One of the downsides of this proposal is that I think if it were to pass, it would forestall what we really need, which is a comprehensive overhaul of the corporate tax system, which in the past the president has supported. So on its own, done once, this would not necessarily be a bad idea. But I think viewed more as part of a comprehensive process where tax reform is an alternative, I think it would be unfortunate.
I mean, the White House is saying what they're trying to get to is tax reform here, that they don't want a one-time tax holiday. This was the Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew. This was just Tuesday this week, testifying in front of the House Ways and Means Committee, saying tax holidays, bad idea.
We've pointed out many times that we think that the one-time repatriation holiday created a kind of perverse incentive. It created an incentive for companies to keep their income overseas until the next repatriation holiday. We think that the right answer is to have real tax reform, to change the structure so that companies bring their income home, frankly, so they invest their income wherever it's most economically efficient.
Matthew Slaughter, do you see this devolving into just another tax holiday, or is there a chance of a real negotiation here? Maybe it won't be a 14% one-time hit on the earnings pile up abroad. Maybe it'll be something lower, but something that would come home and pay for some better roads.
I hope it doesn't devolve. As Alan pointed out, these tax holidays are a terrible policy. They don't change the permanent decisions of companies in terms of where they hire and where they invest. And the academic research on the 2004 tax holiday showed pretty convincingly very few jobs were created in the wake of that by the companies that repatriated that one-time bonus, unlike what some people had hoped.
That was the whole idea. That was the way it was sold to the country by the Bush administration, right? We'll let this come back and it'll gin up jobs.
So the right way to think is, as Secretary Lew said and many others have on both sides of the aisle, is about permanent structural tax reform. And here the devil is in the details. Jonathan earlier from Bloomberg pointed out, outgoing Chairman Camp of the House Ways and Means Committee last year submitted a comprehensive tax reform bill, but the devil is in the details on these things. The tax rate that he proposed effectively for worldwide income of U.S.-based multinationals for most types of income was just 1.25%. So that proposal is much closer in actuality to this territorial tax system that people tend to talk about that we should move towards. That's the kind of business tax system that most countries around the world today have. And so the hope is that somehow the tax reform conversations will get to comprehensive reform that is fair in terms of broadening the tax base that many companies see, and to try to do away with a lot of these special exemptions and loopholes like these tax holidays.
Alan Auerbach, I mean, the Obama administration is talking that kind of reform. They're saying they're ready to bring the top, the corporate tax rate down from 35% to 28%, I think. And here they're talking 14% one time, 19% ongoing. That's a lot higher than 1.25 proposed by David Camp. Do we have to go that low, Alan Auerbach, on how we tax foreign earnings to keep our multinationals globally competitive?
These represent two different philosophies of international taxation. As Matt suggested, most other countries have moved more toward a territorial system. The administration's proposal would move us to strengthen what we already have, which is a so-called worldwide tax system. There are arguments for, on both sides, and it would be useful to have that discussion. I have other views. I think there are still other alternatives that might be tried, but I think it would be much more productive to have a discussion about what these rates should be, what the exact structure should be, and to consider all the proposals at the same time. As I said before, my concern is that by focusing on the 14% tax on offshore earnings as a sort of a cash machine for infrastructure, it will move us away from what the president has said in the past he wants, which is comprehensive reform.
It's being presented as an opening gambit there. Let's hear from our listeners. Melissa in Savannah, Georgia. What do you think, Melissa? Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great conversation. It's so critical. Infrastructure is truly at its breaking point. I think it's so critical to keep the flow of things, especially in the 21st century. How about we reinstate some of the defunct rail lines in the regions around the nation? Real connectivity, right? We're all connected digitally. Why not in reality? You know, the pedestrian gets to the bridge. Now they're risking their lives on the shoulder of the road. Let's cantilever a safety walkway, you know, a memorial pathway, for goodness sake, for all the people that have lost their lives. You know, safety and efficiency in moving people from point A to point B cleanly, sustainably for future generations. Our leaders have a civic responsibility, and the people that have benefited hand over fist to the tune of billions have a civic responsibility to get it done and to get it right for future generations.
Melissa, I'm right there with you. Let me put it to our economist, Matthew Slaughter. There was a time when the United States led the world in its infrastructure. Now here we are. Everything's patched and falling apart. We're still a wealthy country despite all of our problems. The gas tax hasn't covered it. You're saying this is too high, what the White House is proposing now. Why are we having so much trouble staying up to date? Are other countries taking on debt that we shouldn't take on? Do they have a better tax system? What is the fundamental problem? Why on earth should we have lousy infrastructure?
Well, that's a great question, Tom, and Melissa's insights really get to the heart of the matter. When you look at other countries around the world, I think it's two basic things that differ a lot from the United States. One is, even in emerging markets like China, you look at the breadth of their infrastructure build out over the past generation or two. They fund it through broad taxes at the federal and sometimes the state and local level. But the second thing that we might benefit from talking more about in the United States is what are oftentimes called public-private partnerships. So many other countries have tried to draw capital in to their infrastructure investments from private investors, not just from public taxation. And actually around the world, in a lot of countries, there's a lot of knowledge and expertise that have been built up in certain governments and in certain companies in these public-private partnerships where you build, fund, and maintain the different kind of infrastructures like Melissa was mentioning. It'd be terrific if that was part of the conversation today as well.
Alan Auerbach, I see some of that proposed, I think, in what the White House is putting out, but it looks like only a billion or $1.5 billion worth of municipal bonds and private investment versus hundreds of billions required.
Well, that's right. It's really just a start. You might think of it as a demonstration project. I think one thing else worth keeping in mind about why the U.S. is lagged behind in infrastructure spending compared to, you know, we could think back to the Eisenhower years of the building in the interstate highway system, for example, is that we now spend, leaving interest aside, the federal government now spends about half of all dollars that are spent on three programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And if we go back 50 years, we were spending virtually nothing on those programs. And that, as much as anything else, is an explanation for why we're spending less on schools, less on highways, less on the things that we tend to associate government with, because the money is going into these other programs. Now, of course, we could increase the size of the federal budget, and that's something that some people want to do, but trying to keep the budget in the same basic situation and spending more and more and more on these programs, which we didn't spend on in the past, means there'll be fewer dollars for the things that we traditionally think of government as providing.
Let's go to Bill in Panama City, Florida. Bill, thanks for calling. What do you think, sir?
Well, I think the common sense is gone. Corporate, you mentioned the 14%. The common sense is to take it from the corporate. I believe all those corporations use the highways and byways. So I would think that they would be also involved in doing the infrastructure. Seems like everything is put on the middle class, and it's dying. And if the corporations are in the billions of dollars of profits, I think it would be in their interest to keep the infrastructure high so they can move their products.
Bill, I hear you, and I hear the common sense element of that. If the White House is thinking politically here as they propose this, they're kind of thinking of your perspective right there. Let me hold that and get one more, if I may. Jim in Shell Rock, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm an independent operator, truck driver, and I pay heavy road tax, and I pay tax on my fuel already, so I'm not in favor of the fuel tax, but I am in favor of the corporate tax because, you know, they're making billions of dollars in profit. I think they're kind of behind on the infrastructure. I mean, there's roads out here that needed to be repaired years ago. I drive on two roads and across bridges, two of them have signs at them that says only safe for one truck, yield for any truck over 10,000 pounds. There's two of them that way that I drive across.
That's scary. In the USA, it just shouldn't be like that. Jim, I appreciate your call. Matthew Slaughter, there are two callers in a row saying, don't do this on the back of the middle class. Yes, we have an urgent need, but go corporate. They've got a lot of, that's where the money is.
Well, two things come to mind, and I hear what Bill and Jim are saying. One is, if we're thinking about the business sector, the U.S.-based multinational companies that we're talking about, if I count companies, there's only about 3,000 companies in the eyes of the IRS that fall in this category of U.S.-based multinationals that have ownership and operation of at least one foreign business. There's about 30 million businesses in the United States of all forms of partnerships and S-corps and C-corporations if you add them all up. So this conversation we're having, if we're thinking about the business sector, we're only talking about a very, very narrow piece of it. And I think a second—
Those that are so active abroad, but still GE ships its stuff around the United States on American roads?
I agree. But the other thing to keep in mind is it's not just what we're doing in the United States, despite what we might like to think. We're a terrific country, best in the world in many ways, I'll be the first to say. But it's what we're doing compared to other countries. If you look at the other 34 countries in the OECD altogether, their average corporate tax rate today is only about 25%. And it continues to fall as so many other countries realize that with these mobile companies, that better tax regime is to think about other economic activities to tax to try to fund these sorts of investments in infrastructure. Even countries like Germany and Japan that we don't always think of as being pro-business have been very aggressive in recent years in simplifying their tax regimes and reducing their corporate tax rates.
Alan Auerbach, in a word, is the middle class going to have to shoulder this? Our callers are saying enough already.
Well, the middle class is going to have to shoulder part of it, and they may end up shouldering it even if the tax is placed. At least initially on corporations. Certainly to the extent that corporations are discouraged from operating in the U.S. by anything that we do, which is not to say that this is a particularly bad idea, but ultimately taxes, corporations are they're representative of their shareholders, of their customers, of their workers, and when we impose taxes on corporations, it's going to fall on somebody.
Alan, hold that thought. Matt Slaughter as well. Robert Puentes joins us to look ahead on American infrastructure when we return. This is On Point.
Imagine having a personal library with over 150,000 titles. Fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. Now imagine having a personal assistant read them to you in your car, on the train, wherever you want. That's what it's like to have Audible.com. On Point listeners get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint. Download a free title and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American taxes and American infrastructure, looking at the president's push to tax American companies abroad to rebuild roads, rails, bridges, and more at home. Just this week, while the budget proposal is coming out, there's also been a big report put out by the Department of Transportation about the next 30 years the year 2045 in American transportation, a lot of talk about multimodal transportation. That would be a big change in emphasis for this country. Here's Secretary of Transportation talking with NPR's Morning Edition just today.
We have a chronic level of underinvestment in infrastructure, but I think the piece that probably hasn't gotten as much attention is how we're spending our money, how it's actually going into the system that we're going to need 30 years from now, needs to be rethought. Hopefully, this report, which doesn't purport to lay out an action plan, but in fact tries to help laser in on what the problems we're going to face are, is a critical foundational piece of allowing that conversation to happen.
The problems we're going to face. We're going to look down that road. Lots of response from our listeners as we discuss these options here. Krista saying, I don't know, but we desperately need improvements now in infrastructure, and this is the time to do it. And interest rates are low, and so many people need jobs. Rosemary says, how are these American companies, quote-unquote, American, when they bail on you, the U.S., regardless of infrastructure needs, after exploiting it? Jeff says, how about we think hard about where the current gas taxes get spent? A note of skepticism right there. On our back, Matthew Slaughter, please stand by. Robert Puentes joins us right now from Washington, senior fellow at Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, directs the infrastructure initiative there. Robert Puentes, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the emphasis of this big 30-year plan? A lot of people worried about what's right under our feet right now. Mm-hmm. But as Anthony Fox, the secretary, looks ahead, what kind of big changes overall is he envisioning for this country's infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, the 30-year plan is different from the budget conversation and the daily conversation around traffic and things like that, because yep. It's designed to lift up the conversation, make it much more aspirational, much more forward-looking, and that matters because this is a majorly disruptive period in America, and it's a once-in-a-century opportunity to really rethink our cities, our metro areas. I mean, these demographic changes that we're facing, shrinking household sizes, domestic migration, immigration, we're a growing country. All these things have profound impacts on the transportation system and our infrastructure. It's how we work. It's more collaborative. It's where we live. There's a huge demand for things like transit access, how we get around. Driver's licensing is, you know, among the lowest in a generation for young people. All these things.
In other words, they don't drive. They're not as car centric as their parents were, young people.
Something different happening with younger generations. And so what this report is designed to do is to look at these trends and look at these changes, because the transportation network doesn't exist in the abstract. It's designed to support these larger demographic, environmental, economic changes that this nation is facing right now.
So we need improvements right now, and you know all about that, but we need a flow of revenue over time to build that future. What I read here in Anthony Fox's comments on this 30-year report is kind of the break with the Eisenhower era. This seems like the move away from car-centric, highway-centric, or dominated transportation in this country. He talks all the time about choice and multimodal ideas.
And not a moment too soon. I mean, this is what folks are looking for now is not just one mode. It's not just transit. It's not just highways. It's not just freight. It's not just ports. All of these things work together. And the problem that we've had in this country for so long is we've taken this very siloed approach. We're one of the only industrialized countries on the planet that separates these things out this way. And so what we're trying to do, and I think what the secretary is trying to do, is to recognize this is a system of systems. People want choices. Businesses want choices. And if we're going to compete in the 21st century, we've got to start to recognize all these things work together and not in competition with one another.
Tie it back, though, to the debate going on now about how to pay for current needs, because implicit there is ongoing revenue as well. I mean, where would you plant our feet when it comes to paying for infrastructure now and in the future? Should we be raising the gas tax? Should we be going to these overseas earnings and tapping into them? How do you see it?
The problem with this silo system is that it's all funded in different ways. It's designed, financed, governed, and delivered all differently. So the gas tax is the workhorse for things like roads and bridges and public transit, things like that, on surface transportation. There are other areas of infrastructure, things like airports, that are funded very differently. A lot of municipal governments and states, some of the private sector goes into that. The freight rail system is really the envy of the world all over, and that's entirely private driven. So, you know, sidewalks, a lot of these things are municipal led. So we've got to figure out how these things are funded. We've got to then have that conversation. But as it relates to the national conversation, yeah, the fuel tax is the thing we're going to have to raise in the short term, extremely unpopular, probably off the table in the short term. So this idea for looking at corporate profits is, you know, is plan B, plan C. I don't even know where it is on the list now. But it's just trying to figure out how we're going to be able to plug in these immediate holes because the challenges are pretty severe.
I mean, the fuel tax, though, isn't paying the freight, right? We're falling $50 billion or more per year short. We're just borrowing that to, just to keep up with some portion of our infrastructure maintenance and repair needs, if I'm right, Bob.
That's exactly right. I mean, on the federal level, see, the federal government pays for about maybe 25%, 30% of this transportation network. The states, the cities, the municipalities, the metropolitan areas are paying for a lot of the rest of it. So there's two different conversations going on. There's the national conversation, mm-hmm. Which dominates, but we probably overemphasize that in a lot of ways. And we do see, in light of the debt and dysfunction that's happening in Washington, the states raising their own gasoline taxes, states as red as Wyoming, states as blue as Maryland. They're going to the voters. They're approving these sales tax referenda, another referenda every election day to pay for discrete mm-hmm. infrastructure projects. So it's a very different conversation in Washington than that's happening in metro areas across the country.
How do you explain, with all of your focus on this, how other countries now, industrial countries, have so much better infrastructure than the United States does? Do they have a better system? What is it? Can we adopt it? Are they spending like drunken sailors and borrowing to do it? How do you explain our lag here?
Yeah, some do, some don't. I think that the one key element that some of the countries that we look at aspirationally have is that they have these larger visions for what they're trying to accomplish. They usually have these economic plans. It's an economic strategy that they have, and then infrastructure and transport is derivative of that economic strategy. So here in this country, for example, the president had an initiative to double exports in 5 years to take advantage of rising global demand for U.S. firms. It's a great economic initiative. That should then throw off infrastructure projects designed to meet that around ports or mm-hmm. around freight, things like that. We fail to make that connection in this country, which other countries seem to do with much more clarity.
Let's go to our listeners. Mike in Normal, Illinois. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say I couldn't agree with Anthony Fox more. We need to make smart choices when it comes to our infrastructure. In this community, they're looking at a new ring road. Could cost an estimated $300 million to build along the community's east side, and investing just 10% of that could create a transit system that is so convenient that drivers would choose that over getting in the car and driving to work. We've had a 40% increase in bus trips in this community in the last 3 years. That's almost 3 million rides in the community the size of Bloomington Normal.
But the answer for a long time has been, if you want to grow, build roads, Mike.
Well, the road might be needed, but you have to look at both. You have to take both into consideration. It could be that the transit system, investing in transit, could mean that $300 million cost in that road is delayed or even deferred forever.
Yeah, Mike, I really appreciate your call. Robert Puentes, how about it? Are Americans going to go through some grinding kind of whiplash here if we get on Anthony Fox's shift to multimodal? You know, here's one town, Twin Cities, Bloomington Normal, they want to build a ring road. Well, if that doesn't fit the 30-year theme, and they don't, do they just get, do they suddenly go all multimodal and that fixes it? Or do they just get a lot of traffic they can't handle without the road?
Right. Well, I wouldn't overemphasize. I mean, again, I think what the secretary laid out is again, it's very good. It's very aspirational. It's not a complete whiplash shift from highways into something completely different. Again, you talked about this earlier. It really is about lots of different options. It's choices, and it's a range of alternatives. We've been tethered to one mode mm-hmm. For so long, to the automobile and to highway construction for so long in most of the country, that what Americans are asking for, not just folks like the caller, but businesses, recognizing that it's not about moving people and moving goods. It's really about access. And how do you then provide people with access to economic opportunity, to jobs, to education, to entertainment, whatever it is you're trying to get to? Mm-hmm. Transportation is a means to an end. It's not – we've got to get away from a system that's just moving things around. It's not moving it around. You're actually trying to get people – get goods to market, get people to work – and advance the economy broadly. That's got to be the frame that we have to have for all of this.
Matt Slaughter, let us put this challenge on your plate for a second. You don't really like the taxes on overseas earnings. Okay. I don't know how you feel about increasing the gas tax or some other kind of, travel-related tax, but you hear the challenges. You have a sense of the scale of them. You, like all of us, can see how we've been kind of stuck here. How would you pay for it?
Great question. A little bit of everything, I guess, if you hand me the magic wand. Okay. I would increase the federal gasoline tax. It hasn't been increased since 1993, even in real terms. let alone nominal terms.
That's pretty amazing.
Right, it is. So, and then I would also think about, you know, Mike's insight about the ring road. We can build the capacity, and as Robert pointed out, we want to think strategically, but part of that can be pricing that appropriately. So if you look again around the world, you see large metropolitan areas like London and Singapore where they have built such ring roads or they've already had them, mm-hmm. but what they do is they change the pricing. So certain times of day, if you want to drive into central London, you have to pay a surcharge, whether you're a truck or whether you're a single person in your own vehicle. And that has dramatically altered how people think about moving the goods and themselves around.
Are those toll roads, or you just got a sensor on your car or truck? I know it's very expensive to drive into central London at many times of day now.
Right, different combinations. And so with technology, again, on Robert's insight about being smart, you build the IT infrastructure with all these advances in smart technology. It can be very automatic with smart passes and mm-hmm. easy passes. So it's those user fees can be appropriate as well. And I'll come back to something Alan said. I think he was spot on when he said, some of this is going to have to be paid for by the middle class. I mean, all of us as Americans, we all use this infrastructure. We want it to be improved for ourselves, for our children, for the future. All of us somehow should be paying a bit more to fund this as well.
Alan Auerbach, what about the distribution of who's paying for what now? Is there a fair distribution, the burden of paying for our infrastructure between ordinary citizens and corporate users? There's a lot of big trucks rumbling down those roads, putting,
To a large extent, this is an ethical question, and it really we haven't talked about the distribution of income in the U.S., but I think a lot of the unhappiness of middle-class individuals in the U.S. relates not only to their tax burden, but to the fact that their incomes have been stagnant while the incomes at the top have been going up. Now, they tend to associate corporations with those at the top. That's not exactly accurate in the sense that corporations also are, you know, their pension funds are mm-hmm. more shareholders of corporations, others who are not necessarily in the 1%. But certainly the tension of trying to find broad-based ways of paying for taxes that may hit everybody and at the same time sheltering the middle class is central to this discussion. The president has tried very hard in the last few years to limit the burden of tax changes or tax increases to people at the very top. To a certain extent, one can do that, but if you're talking about very large spending programs, that's going to turn out to be unrealistic.
Robert Puentes, do you hear in the corporate arena support for coming in and helping pay for this? I remember an ad for an Audi kind of supercar a few years ago, a magazine ad that was really disturbing. And it was a beautiful, amazing car with huge sort of nubby tires. It looked like it could handle anything. And all it was in this very forbidding, falling down infrastructure. Like, everything's falling apart, but if you're rich enough to buy this Audi car that can drive across any kind of terrain, you'll be fine. That's the opposite of everybody pitching and getting it done. Where the money is there also readiness to help pay?
Yes. And again, I think some of that is evidenced by what's happening outside of Washington. Again, when we go to the voters, they're willing to pay. When you talk to corporations, infrastructure is the top of the list. And it's as groups as diverse as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. I mean, this is not that contentious of an issue. But where you get the money is the big challenge. And so I think what Alan and Matt were talking about is exactly right. We've got to figure out how we come up with a rational plan for raising the money, but then it also matters of how we're going to actually spend it. And you can ameliorate some of the problems for, particularly for low-income and middle-income households by spending the money the right way. If we're really focused on making sure that people have access to jobs and economic opportunity, you can make that as a criteria for how we're choosing these investments. And when people see the investments that are being made, they are willing to pay for it because they recognize the need for these kinds of this kind of spending. But if it's just this big black box approach and a Washington, just trust us, we're going to raise the gas tax, it's going to go into Washington, and don't worry, it's all going to work out, that's not going to fly with people today.
You're our guest in Washington today, Bob. I mean, gas prices are at a very low moment right now. If you're ever going to add a quarter a gallon, it always hurts, but it hurts a little less when they're down in the $2 something range and when it's $4 and something. Do you see a readiness to get together across the aisle and get something done to get us on a better track here?
Not exactly. I mean, it's closer than it's been. There's a crack in the door, and all that. Mm-hmm. But it's tough. I mean, the administration has said no. I mean, key leaders in Congress have said no. You're right for all the intellectual reasons that it makes sense to do this now. But we've got to figure out a better way to sell this to people. It can't just be we've got a budget crisis we've got to solve, and that's why we're going to do this.
How long can you fool around with this? People talk about the infrastructure crumbling. At some point, doesn't it become a critical problem?
there's an immediate problem with this Highway Trust Fund, as was talked about before, getting ready to go bankrupt at the end of May. We've got to figure out something between now and then. We've got roads and bridges that are in bad condition. We've got transit systems. We see tragic things happening in cities across the country with a lot of regularity. So, it's a good question to understand, when is it going to reach this kind of crisis stage that people start to pay attention?
I think you've got people paying attention right now as they look at those cracks and crumbling bits. Appreciate all three of you being with us today to look more closely at this. Robert Puentes, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution, the Metropolitan Policy Program there. Robert, Bob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Slaughter at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Matt, thank you for being here today. Very grateful to you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
And Alan Auerbach, Professor of Economics and Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Alan, thank you for helping us out here today.
And thank you for having me on.
Listeners, thanks for all your input on the air and online. It's always great to have you. Check out our podcast. You can get it at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.